Brad Steiger with us this hour. Let's talk monsters with him as we talk about his work, Real Encounters, Different Dimensions, and Other Worldly Beings. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Brad Steiger with us. Brad, you know, you've looked at monsters for so long. You've run the gamut from the old guard of werewolves and vampires and those traditional monsters that we all hear so much about. And then the new ones, the strange ones, the shadow people, the black-eyed kids. I always get asked about them at speaking engagements wherever I go. People are scared of those kids.
Yeah. If I may, if I can just give the punchline to the story I was telling about Sherry and the lady who sat down and said, when I brought the ladies together, they swore beforehand that they didn't know each other and had never met each other and had never taken a class together. And then when I got them together, I could see clearly that they had never met each other, never taken a class together. But the lady, Mary Carolyn Meadows, who lives in Phoenix area, we call her now our fairy godmother, because here she was clearly used by this intelligence to bring Sherry and myself together. And she was unwitting. You know, she didn't realize what she said, that I should meet Sherry and get together with her.
It was magical.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have to say, when something like that happens to you, and believe me, George, I've gone over it and over it. Did I really sit down beside a woman I hadn't met before? Did she really tell me that she was bringing me greetings from a woman I had only met briefly 2 or 3 years before? I mean, it just it boggles my mind every time I try to go over it, but it happened that way.
It's magical. Okay, back to the wolves and the monsters.
Back to the wolves.
So we've got new ones and old ones.
Pardon me?
We've got the new monsters and the old monsters.
Right. And I find it fascinating to see. Now we have the werewolf, the vampire. The vampire really had a strong run. And the zombies now are, you know, are captivating with their rotting bodies, you know, huge masses of people. The Walking Dead was the highest viewing a couple of
years ago. Oh, yeah, it sure was.
So I think we have these images that truly become archetypal. They're timeless, and they keep emerging, re-emerging, but new variations are added. So angels and genies, wee people, devils, they've been popular in all cultures throughout history, and they keep being reactivated. But now we're adding, like, Slender Man.
Tell me about Slender Man.
Yeah, Slender Man is this entity that literally, I had Pastor Robin Swope kind of track it down. This is his area as a pastor, and he was intrigued by it as well. And it seems to just have begun on a talk show where they were talking about, well, let's create a monster. Okay, here's this tall, thin man, and he goes after children. He grabs children. Now, you know, interesting, throughout all history, children are the primary victims, which I find interesting. The Slender Man is the boogeyman of today. And this is now multiplied. People are seeing Slender Man. They're having encounters with Slender Man. And it's become the thing that, you know, you better get to bed or Slender Man is coming type of thing. But the black-eyed kids, I find that very fascinating. Because, you see, first we have the men in black. Then we have shadow people. And then we have the black-eyed kids. You know, there's a nice progression there. And why is it, again, children? This time, it is not children that are being pursued. It's kids that are the pursuers, which is a very interesting kind of switch. The idea, well, I first heard, before it became a fad with black-eyed kids, I started getting reports from people who claimed they would be on a date and they'd come out of a theater, and there'd be these kids that would kind of harass them and give them a bad time. They'd get in the car, but before that, they noticed that their pupils were just solid black. But then the same couple would go to a restaurant. They come out of the restaurant. There are those kids again. Wherever they went, they are harassed by these kids. So this story, the first one really I heard some kind of length, they went back to the girlfriend's apartment. And here, these black-eyed kids have been following them all over. And this is a major city. This is a major city in California.
And what was the grouping, like three or four?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, three or four kids, always. Same three or four. They get back. Now they go way across town, go to his girlfriend's apartment. They aren't there but minutes, and the doorbell rings. And guess who's on the step?
There they are.
Yeah. Can we use your telephone? You know.
Let us in. They want to get in.
After pursuing them all night, can we use your telephone? Can we use your bathroom? Well, of course, in this case, the guy said, look, I don't know who you creeps are, but I am calling the police. Well, then they left, and they just saw that the police were there in minutes, but they had completely disappeared. Now, I've heard from people who have made the mistake of saying, oh, these poor kids, it's a cold night out. Sure, you can come in and use my bathroom. And these black-eyed kids had just torn the place apart before they disappeared. Now, interestingly, as we progress from that, the shadow people, I know you've talked about shadow people a lot.
Oh, sure.
This could be, here again, you know, something you see out of the corner of your eye, which, again, if you want to explain it that way, but if you want to recognize, as many people swear, that this has been a phenomena that has been bothering them for quite some time, it could be, you know, just the dimensional, not quite coming through from this multidimensional reality near us. But an interesting thing I heard from another researcher not too long ago and asking me, now get this, about the archetype resurfacing. He had been getting reports of the Harlequin bothering people, attacking people, spying on people, getting into their house. The Harlequin. Now, that goes back to the Middle Ages.
It sure does.
Now, pretty soon, in about a week, people are going to be putting on their Harlequin masks and dressing up. Again, the Harlequin, you know, half of his suit is black and the other is white. And the entity then that resurfaces. Now, how in the world the Harlequin? And who even knows the Harlequin today? And then Sherry said, well, wait. Back in the late 60s, maybe early, late 50s, 60s, 70s, the Keene people, the husband and wife artist team, you remember them? They would do the kids with the big eyes.
Yeah.
And everyone had at least one in their home. Well, they also did Harlequins. So maybe that resurfaced with an image now that we have the same other. We call it the other, as I said in the book, because we don't know what it is. But this could be another guise. This could be another accoutrement that the other can present itself. Any way to contact, to get emotion. And it may be living on emotion. This particular other could be living on fear, could be living on startling people, that energy that's projected when we're frightened. But the Harlequin, so in other words, we know that angels and genies and so forth have been popular throughout history, but we're gaining a few more now. The Slender Man is really nothing but a variation of the vampire or the werewolf. He comes out of the woods, goes after children particularly, and it's just amazing to us researching this, how these archetypes of monsters keep perpetuating generation after generation, and they go all the way back. People have always seen, well, the cave paintings, paintings, and the famous cave in France. What are those? Those are half man, half animal. Those are the same kind of monsters, the werewolves, the were-man, the were-humans They've been painting it. We've been seeing werewolves and creatures, you know, since Paleolithic times.
Do these creatures want to hurt you or just menace you?
I think, again, it's a question of energy, primarily. Question of energy. Though, again, I think if one says, "Oh, great beast, I worship you. I bring you into my life. I bring you into my spirit." Bad choice. There again, just like a demonic intelligence, we can bring this evil part, and I use evil, you know, I struggle with it sometimes, you know. Do we create evil? There is no evil. We create it. I don't know. I've been out in the world long enough and been to enough houses where horrible murders have taken place, other places where evil, just pure evil, you have to admit it. Houses are possessed, I think, by evil itself. So I think with caution, when we know what we're talking about, we can open ourselves. Now, I wanted to make one point, and I'm talking too fast, excuse me,
no,
but I get excited about this. With the black-eyed boys, what do? They appear at the doors, and they said, they always say, "May we come in?"
They have to come in. For sure.
Right. Now, we know throughout all history, there's one rule, whether it's Dracula or whoever it is, they have to be invited before they can have. Well,
we have to invite
evil into our lives before it can have any power over us.
Well, that's true. I mean, how many people try to conjure up the devil by asking for him to show up?
Right. But even Bloody Mary, show yourself in the mirror, even these simple little rituals that people do. Yes, I know, they are simple rituals, and we shouldn't say, "Oh, don't do it, then the monster will appear." But too many times, something has opened the doorway, something in that eager young psyche, or that eager psyche that wants to be a follower of some power, opens himself or herself up to great detriment.
Brad, where do you think these black-eyed kids are from?
I think they're from the same area that Slender Man is from. I think they're from the unconscious.
Huh.
I think that we possess that energy that always exists around us. We, through our unconscious and through expectation of, and sometimes anticipation of something beyond us. And if we want contact with the beyond. We want contact with the mystical.
People want that desperately.
But yeah, we want that. But again, unless we approach it with some seriousness and study, it's not something, you don't just go to an empty house after the football game on Saturday night and become a ghost hunter. You don't just sit down with a Ouija board and become a medium. Part of our embracing of the mystical, the paranormal by the mass media now is a two-edged sword. More people accept it, more people are willing to hear about it, but more people are opening themselves to it without proper protection, without proper study, without proper respect.
You know, back to prayer for a second, Brad, which kind of ties into this. People need or expect some kind of divine providence to come and save them.
Yes.
To bail them out.
Right.
These angels that we pray to and God that we pray to, what creates that miracle when they come and save us? Because it does happen.
Oh, it does happen. It does indeed. Now, first of all, you know, the angels themselves, if they're, you know, here you have to say, are you a good angel or a bad angel? But the true angel, who are not spirits of the dead, like Clarence and It's a Wonderful Life, angels in all the religious traditions are a species, an energy apart from us. They were created. You know, we have the angels in the Hindu culture, we have the angels and the demons, the good demons, the bad demons, and then we have humans.
Yeah.
So I think that is kind of an extension that we might say, whether we're Christians, Jewish, Muslim. I think that kind of ancient Hindu approach is maybe, and I'm not championing one, but it sounds right to me. And we don't pray to angels. That's an absolute no-no. But we can by, I don't know, the most convincing stories of angels that we put into our books are those where people haven't prayed, "Oh, angel, come save me." Sometimes that happens, but generally it's where someone really has exhausted all of the
all that he or she could
to gain. And we have some incredible stories. We have some in this book. And we have some in our angel books. They're just incredible.
Give me one of your favorites.
Pardon me?
Give me one of your favorite stories.
Well, one of the favorites from this book, I think, is, you know, it's so simple. A woman who's blind, she generally has someone walking her to the pharmacy and back, and here's a stormy night, and she's confused. Her friends didn't show up to help walk her, but she has to have her medication. And suddenly then, as she's stumbling in the dark, she feels a hand, and the sound of a very gentle man's voice saying, "May I help you, miss?" Well, she's always a little bit touchy about this, about having anyone touch her, and particularly a stranger, because of her handicap. But there's something in his voice, and there's something in the touch. And the man leads her to the pharmacy, enters in, and then leaves. Later, she's wondering how she will get home, and she says, "I wish that man would come again." And the pharmacist said, "Well, there wasn't any man that came with you, but I see your neighbor over there, you know, and I know she will be happy to give you a ride home." So here again, this person that appeared. Now, there's a story in there that I just love. I don't know how much time we have before a break.
You got about a minute and a half or so.
Well, just quickly, I will say. They fall upon hard times, the family. And this young boy, he's barely a teenager, and he's not big for his age, but he's going to help. He's going to go away and earn money for the family and send it home to the family. Well, he's gone. They haven't heard from him for a while. I'm really rushing the story here. But the essence of it is the woman dreams that night of a young Hispanic boy that comes. "Your son needs you. Your son needs you. I will take you." Now, is this a dream? What is this? But she allows herself to be led, and she comes into an old attic, and there's just, rotten things and boards, and there's her son lying there racked with fever, and she ministers, and he says, "Mom, is it really you?" "Yes, son, I'm here." So she then awakens back in her bed, and the pieces that come together, and I'm just rushing a beautiful story very quickly. The two boys had befriended each other on their quest to find work. The young Hispanic boy had been killed. The boy in the attic, it wasn't an attic, it was in a lumber camp.
I'm going to let you finish it up, Brad. We'll take some more time for it when we come right back. Well, next hour, we're going to talk about the Dyatlov Pass incident. It's one of the strangest stories I've ever heard. So make sure you're listening to that. And when we come back in a moment, we're going to take phone calls with Brad Steiger and let him finish up on that story as well. And we'll take your calls with Brad Steiger in a moment. Brad, the break hit us right in the middle of your story. I'll let you finish up. You've got more time for it now.
Oh, thank you. Because this is significant because we have a couple chapters dealing with the multidimensional reality that we all face in dreams. And when we have spontaneous out-of-body experiences. So just the dream world shows us, you know, what are dreamings and why do we dream and what are the dimensions and why does it seem so real? You know, are we entering? And certainly during fevers and that kind of natural body phenomena that alters the normal body processes, you know, we have this altered reality that we enter so often, and it's part of the whole mystery and magic of what we're dealing with this phenomena. This story was so significant to me, and why it's one of my favorites is, I'll just quickly go through it again.
Sure.
Just the high points. Okay, we have a young man, a valorous young man, who leaves the family to help their difficult financial situations. He becomes friends with a young Hispanic boy. They team up. They get odd jobs. They work here and there. The Hispanic boy then is killed in an accident. The other boy goes on and finds work in a lumber camp. He becomes ill. And he is actually in the bunkhouse at this lumber camp. And he is terribly ill, running a high fever. The family hasn't heard from him for weeks, for months. They have no idea where he is.
Petrified.
You can imagine the distress the family has. So this dream one night, this young boy, Hispanic boy, comes to the mother and says, come with me. The woman in the dream state, we have to assume, or out of body, we can also assume, goes with him. Now, the young boy is in such a high fever that he imagines he's in a rotting attic. He's actually in a hospital now, a hospital bed. He was in the lumber camp where the workmen, he was taken then by the employer when he saw that this kid was ready, I mean, he was dying, took him to a hospital. So he is, and in his fevered dream, he sees himself in a rotting attic. The mother with the ghost, the spirit, whichever you please, with the mother enters his dream reality. The mother then kneels beside him, cradles him. Oh, mother, I'm so happy you've come, and gives spiritual healing to him. Then she goes back, wakes up in her own bed the next day. In another day or so, they receive word from this hospital where the son has been taken, and they find him there then, and all of this is done in a dream by a young man's spirit getting the mother to apply her healing energy to her desperately ill son.
I love that.
And I think that's just one of the neatest examples and stories of how we can reach out, how we're always in touch with one another, how we can always rely upon spirit, true spirit, to bring us together, and the whole impossibility of putting boundaries upon the greater reality.
Do you believe that good will defeat evil eventually and most of the time?
I believe that in the long run, light always vanquishes darkness. The smallest ray of light pierces darkness. And I believe, you know, call me cockeyed optimist here, and I know Sherry agrees, that light will always conquer darkness.
That's a good attitude. Let's go to Tom in Port Angeles, Washington, west of the Rockies, to get us started. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
You are very welcome.
Could you recount the story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin and how it relates to those, how it relates to the children that were saved from a town that was basically lost in immorality?
Well, that's interesting. We were just talking about the Pied Piper of Hamelin and Peter the Hermit and so forth. I got a strange message. Maybe you sent it. I don't know. But we have in the one of the Crusades, which has been perpetually and will perpetually be misunderstood and will always start arguments and fights, but we have the children then following this man with the promise that they are entering the Crusade and that they are going over to free Jerusalem, and with the idea of serving a greater good of that time or in their reality, they were sold into slavery. And certainly then, I think the story to me has always stood as a parable that we should always test. We must always test and evaluate any claims of outrageous promises that are made by people every day, promising this, promising that, promising a salvation, anything of a spiritual, ephemeral nature. To me, that's what the parable means, is to evaluate, to weigh, and to always be wary of one who promises salvation for simply, and what did he promise? They're going over to kill people. So again, just the whole perpetuation throughout history. It's a cautionary tale. Once again, we must always be on guard. We must always evaluate.
Brad, a lot of people, of course, will battle good versus evil. And as you just said, you think good will win out most of the time. What happens to those people that can't beat it? They can't beat evil. Do they get sucked in? What happens?
Well, unfortunately, we have to deal with this in our work, George. I know you do your very best. We've heard you.
It's not easy.
Trying to give people good advice and trying to guide people. You can say it's their karma. You can say it's their fate. But again, Sherry and I cannot help ourselves trying to help others. And I know perhaps we're interfering with what is to be their destiny. That's a very difficult question to answer. And I think each case is individual, and you have to take each case on its own merits and then ask your guidance, ask your higher self to guide you in what should be your answer to that person.
We've got a picture that you supplied us that's on the coasttocoastam.com website highlight reel if you want to look at it. It's a set of drawings that a Z. Peterson, I guess, got to you. Can you tell us about this? This looks like a reptilian ET.
He said a combination of reptilian and amphibian. This I sent along for us to talk about tonight, at least briefly. The individual is a professional person. Not that that means it's, you know, we must take it. But the person itself is very objective, and as you can see, he is a mental health technician. But I think this represents so much of what we're dealing with in this book, George, because this is really a kind of mental contact where, again, he was pulled into this alternate reality. That's the best I can explain it. And again, he may not precisely agree, but he's very open-minded. And he had, just detailed and very intimate kind of experiences when he was pulled into what I prefer calling another dimension rather than an alien world. And I guess, it really doesn't matter. I don't think you have to quibble about. But he felt the hands were important. There's something so significant about
their strength. Hands. They're all webbed.
Yeah, they're definitely webbed because he felt that these were basically aquatic beings. He felt that they were basically existing, well, like, as we said, amphibians or reptiles. And again, the constant emergence of the reptilian in human history. I mean, all the way back, you know, to Quetzalcoatl, the flying serpent, and the culture barriers of Sumeria were amphibian beings that rose from an Ea, the great reptilian amphibious beings. And I came across an old book written in the 1800s by someone who had spent time with the Indian tribes and related an ancient story of how the early Native Americans had to fight off reptilian tribes. Now that, in the significance and the astounding commonality of the reptilian and contactee and abductee stories, really struck me. You know, has this battle with the reptilian, and do they represent evil, as we are so often, oh, the reptile? No, they always seem to represent wisdom and bringing culture. And Z. Peterson said that he felt warmth, an incredible warmth, and wisdom from these beings. And it's a very detailed story. We have another one from a gentleman who I knew as a businessman. And I was surprised. I knew he had an interest in the paranormal, but he too claims mental contact that allows him to bridge the universe, mm-hmm, and make contact. And I think, I wonder if this isn't truly what's happening. People who claim they've been aboard, people who claim they've undergone, if again, these aren't mental, if these aren't, well, let's not say mental because that confuses people, but multidimensional experiences or initiation experiences. There's just so much that we're beginning to see through through a glass darkly.
I'm just amazed, Brad, how these creatures all have similarities, though we look different. You know, right. A couple eyes, a nose, a mouth. It's almost like it's universal throughout the universe.
Well, I think that's what we assume. But that's why we say again and again in the book, the other, we don't know what the other looks like. Really, this may be the image it presented to Mr. Peterson. That another image may be presented to another contactee. They have to, I suppose, be humanoid at least for the percipient, for the experiencer to understand them or relate at all. But we don't really know if this intelligence even has a form. As we say, it may be pure energy, pure light.
All right, let's take a couple more calls here. Tim is in Jacksonville, Florida. Tim, thanks for calling.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good, Timmy.
Hey, Brad, great to have you on the show. Very good stuff.
Thank you.
Hey, I would like to speak about dreams, and I have a story, but if you guys have a second.
Yeah, we've got a few minutes. Go ahead.
I appreciate your one little bit of sidebar. I appreciate your perspective on spirits, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a book at the end of the book talks about, you know, we shouldn't seek familiar spirits. And I always think about that as for fleshly gain. I like your perspective of there are spirits within the world, right? And I do believe them to be angelic, and I do believe them to be demonic.
Mm-hmm.
They can have a positive influence, sometimes a direct influence. Who knows the course of our life, of what's happening before us? You know, whether it's...
Yeah, we don't always know, do we?
No, we don't.
What can seem to be something really bad that happened to it turn out to be one of the greatest gifts we've received?
Yeah, what if we turn something off that has been given to us? But
right.
But we have guidelines that tell us, right? We shouldn't seek, just like New Age stuff. People worship the stars or the seasons or Mother Earth.
Right.
I know I have an opinion about how Earth was made. I love those discussions. I also love opposing views.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lady on talking about the Ouija board. That's probably the first call I had made in forever. And, you know, I understand her opinion, but I also understand mine. That's why we have this show.
She is in favor. That's Karen Dahlman. She's in favor of those Ouija boards. She really is. Brad, we're out of time. Website, bradandsherrywithay.com. The book, Real Encounters, Different Dimensions and Otherworldly Beings. How do you get it?
It's in every bookstore. It's in it's in Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the electronic bookstores. And thank you so much, George, for inviting us on tonight and letting us share thoughts about our book.
Great timing to Halloween, Brad. Thank you.
Yeah.
You take care of yourself. Up next, I'm going to talk about one of the strangest stories I've encountered, maybe in my career, next on Coast to Coast AM.